All right, got a question to ask you for tonight, and I'm going to ask five of you. So if you want to volunteer, raise your hand. One.
Oh, you don't get the question first?
No, but it's an easy question. Two. See, there's two. There's three. It's not a hard. There's four. Washington Redskin guy. Well, give you the last one because that'll give you more time to think. You know, so. Okay. In the Christ ministry, what do you consider His greatest miracle? So whoever comes up with an answer first of the five, what would you consider? Yes?
Raising Lazarus.
Raising Lazarus, okay.
So, you're asking...
His greatest or his most impressive?
Greatest.
Well, I think the miracle of it all is that he survived it himself.
Okay, that's good.
His tolerance and patience with disciples, I mean...
Okay.
That's a miracle to just keep going over and over.
Who was the other one that raised their hand?
The one I like most is the one where he healed the woman who had been bent over 18 years.
Okay, that's a good one. Now Terry's had time to think, so we'll go to Terry.
I like the one where the woman just touched his clothing.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, tonight I'm going to share with you what I think his greatest miracle is. So, Leroy.
Yes, sir.
John 8.
John 8.
Yeah. Roger did a good job as a designated reader, but nobody takes your place. So, start with verse 2.
At dawn he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him and sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery.
All right, let's stop there. Let's put this, as always, very important to put it into a setting. This is, I believe, the Feast of Tabernacles. Jesus has been preaching in the temple off and on during this time. And the Pharisees, Sadducees, and the priest are very, very upset, because they don't want the people going to him. So they began to plot in the Sanhedrin to kill him. And it's at this time that Nicodemus speaks up and reminds them of the law, and also kind of defends Christ to the point that he's asked point blank, well, are you one of his followers? Paraphrasing. Are you one of his followers? Well, this would certainly have been a nice place for Nicodemus to take a stand for Christ, but he didn't. But he was still there trying to prevent the Sanhedrin of doing anything, but he was not strong enough to say, hey, yes, I am a follower. And maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was just pulled towards him. So now we find Jesus again teaching. It's towards the end of the feast. And the Pharisees come up with this plot. And so they bring a woman caught in the very act of adultery. And they drag him, this woman, in front of Jesus, right in front of this big crowd.
They probably fixed it up with the man whoever she was with.
Yes, there's no doubt that this was a contrived situation to put Jesus on the spot. Now, let's see how good your Old Testament history is. A person caught in adultery, generally speaking, what was the punishment? Stoning.
But was it just the woman?
Well, that's my next question. What's missing in this?
Takes
two to tango. What's that verse?
Well,
Oh, okay. Just checking there. I thought maybe I missed that verse somewhere. That's exactly right. First obvious thing is the man's missing. And according to the law, both were equally guilty. In the Jewish law, they said there's three things they said you will not do before you die. You will not commit idolatry, you will not murder, and you will not commit adultery. So these were the three things that the Jews prayed that would never happen in their life. So here comes this woman by herself, caught in the very act. So you can imagine how she must have been dressed and what she looked like. And you can only imagine the fear in her life. So here we have the religious leaders. This would be the same as elders and deacons bringing a woman in our modern context, because these were the religious leaders. So here's a woman caught in the very act. Man's not there. And they come to Jesus, stop everything, and then start over again.
Well, the teachers of the law brought this woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, Rabbi, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. Now, in the law of Moses, it commanded us to stone such woman. Now, what do you say?"
Okay. First of all, how did they address him?
Rabbi.
Rabbi, teacher. Ordinary word has no significance to it, so they're not giving him any credit for anything. We called her in the very act. The law of Moses says, stone her. What do you think? Now, obviously this is a trap. So what do you think they were looking for Jesus to do?
One of two things.
Okay, what's number one?
Well, one, he's been teaching all the people love and mercy.
Okay.
Now, if he says, go ahead, I forgive her, don't do that. Okay. Then he's not in trouble with all these other Pharisees saying, "Whoa, you're saying, just ignore the law of Moses.
Okay.
You're preaching it's okay to go ahead and be an adulteress.
Okay.
In fact, you're encouraging people to be an adulteress."
That's exactly right. So how many times have y'all ever sat on a church board when you said, "We've got to do something. We can't condone sin. We've got to deal with this." So, and if we let this go by, what will happen?
Everybody will do it.
They'll think we're soft on sin. So here the Pharisee says, if he follows what he preaches, we'll have him. Not only would the Pharisees be able to create trouble, the Jewish people around him would have been affected, because all of a sudden they would have been given question to this. Okay? Option number one, let her go. They got him. What's option number two?
Stoner.
Please understand, these guys had stones in their hands. They are ready. What would have been that consequence? Murder in what sense?
Everything he was preaching would just gone down the drain.
Okay. What other sense would it be?
Well, remember, they're under Roman rule.
That's exactly right.
They can't kill people. They can't stone them.
Yeah. So if he says stoner, they're violating the Roman law. Now these guys aren't very, wasn't stupid. This is a tremendous chess move. We've got him in a corner. If he forgives her, say, "Hey, this guy's not even law-abiding. What in the world's going on?" If he says stoner, the Romans will deal with him.
And also, if he forgives, and only God can forgive.
Okay, that's right. So it seems like they got him right where they want him. Read on.
They were using this question as a trap.
It's always nice when the Bible backs up what you say. If you notice that, that's a good feeling. Okay.
That's the basis for accusing him. Well, Jesus bent down and he started to write on the ground with his finger. They kept on questioning
him. Okay, let's stop there. Any eye contact made?
Any what?
Any eye contact made?
No.
Okay.
He was looking straight at the ground.
So he goes...
almost like he's ignored.
Drops to the ground and begins writing. What do you think he was writing?
Names.
Pardon?
The priests or the rulers' names.
Okay. Not sure he wrote their names. Not sure he wrote their names.
He wrote the events.
But he did begin to write out events.
The Aramaic Bible says that when he wrote down, he would begin to write their own sins that they could recognize.
Mm-hmm.
And I have never known where that idea came from until I did some more reading, and it came from the ancient Aramaic Bible, mm-hmm. which is not included in
it. Yeah, it's even from the Bible, you can, even the story itself, and we'll come to the passage in just a second, gives you enough just from the story that that's what he did. Some of the other versions certainly does, and then Desire of Ages certainly states that's what he did. Elder Lewis, who I had the privilege of being in his class down at King a long time ago, says he thinks, and I agree with the principle of it, that he was writing Holiday End, Monday, 27th, 4 to 9 p.m. Gaylord, Sunday and Monday, February, the whatever, you know. He wrote whatever information that as they looked, they recognized. Now, read on and then let's come back to this. Yes?
He wrote just enough so that the specific person would recognize it and no one else.
Yes, yeah. That's why I corrected James very nicely, hopefully, that I don't believe he wrote their names. And that's a very important part of the story. All right, read on, then we're going to come back to this.
Well, when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and he said to them, "If any of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." Again he stooped down, and he wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time. The older ones first.
Okay, let's stop there. You see, I think, why would the older ones leave first? Unless he was writing out their sins. And if you were the older hypocrite,
you'd have more sins.
You'd have more. That's why I think, even though they are making, you're exactly correct, I think we have enough evidence just from that passage. So he began writing out things they had done, and as they looked at it, as they begin to recognize, that's me.
They were fearful of being exposed.
Absolutely. You could hear the thud of the rocks falling, hitting the ground, and then they slowly took off. When they first brought Jesus, they were saying, "What do we do with this woman?" I want to share with you, let's look at the technique he used. Did he argue with them? Did he say anything? Nothing. He ignored them. He just bent down and started writing. They got louder. They got more demanding. And finally he stood up and said, one of the best things a person can say, he without sin, throw the first stone. And immediately went right back to writing out what they were doing. And they came to their own conclusion. Why did he do this way?
Because it was a way of reaching to them without exposing them.
Okay. What other reasons did he do this?
Well, he pointed out their hypocrisy without saying a word.
Okay.
This is the way he taught all the time. Teach by discovery. Mm-hmm. He could have told them what their sins were and he'd start an argument. But this way he did it, they discovered what it was. And you can't argue with what you discover about yourself.
Okay, very good. Why else?
The woman.
We're going to come to the woman in a minute. Why did he do it with these guys, biggest hypocrites, the biggest sinners, set up this woman? By the way, when we get on down the road, we're going to find out he set up with one of the own priests right there, and we're going to see where that one of the leaders comes across Jesus again. Why did he do it that way? Very, very important. Peggy's on the right track. I just didn't want to give credit too early. She's on the right track.
He was still working with those
people,
trying his best to get them to realize their error of their ways and to accept him as the Messiah. I mean, as he said, I came to save the sinners. Mm-hmm. And they're the biggest ones of it.
Well, it blows your mind that they say, oh, how does he know this? Mm-hmm. How does he know?
You
don't see why they don't think that. You know, they don't talk about that, but they
you
had think to
would be
not.
A perfect example for them to straighten up, and instead they went and swatted more.
That's exactly right. You know, we're right back to that principle. When you see truth, it moves you one way or the other. You think the obvious would be is, wow, this guy, how did he know that? This must be something, but it just hardened their heart. The reason I think it's to me the beauty part of this story is exactly what Peggy said. Do you see the kindness of God in publicly not exposing these people to other people? It was in kindness to the biggest hypocrites that he condemned them and pointed out by simply writing out so that they only knew. What does that tell us today on handling people that make mistakes, that fall by the wayside? What do we as church people tend to want to do? Pardon?
Crucify.
Well, I would think we'd go a little bit easier than that one. But,
clean up the church.
Huh?
Yeah, clean up the church.
Yeah, yeah. We've got to expose. Perfect way to expose them. What would it have done? Let's see.
Has there been any changes in that church manual in the last few years?
I don't even know where mine is, so I can't tell you.
I went and read one online about 2 weeks ago, and it was really fascinating, some of the things in there.
See, only love can awaken love. Do you get that? Only love can awaken love.
So those Sadducees and Pharisees probably left there with a certain amount feeling relief because they hadn't been exposed. But that didn't last long.
Didn't do anything for them. So, it's just...
Didn't Christ deal the same way with Judas?
Absolutely. Deals the same way with us. The one thing that we have to grasp in what God is like is that He's the same from Genesis 1 through Revelation 22. He does not change.
Well, Ernie, why does it say Moses says to stone him? Isn't that what God told him to do?
I think that this was... this goes into a long, long discussion, but the bottom line is he was working with a group of people and he directly was speaking to the people. And so when certain things come in open rebellion, God chose to address it. This particular case, this was much different. But he had the opportunity to really put them down, really expose them. And I'm going to kind of give you the story because we'll come across it. One of the men in that group was Simon. He was the ringleader. And we're going to find later, Jesus comes to Simon's house, sits at his table, and we're told by the very fact that Jesus never revealed Simon's role in this whole thing. Simon was touched and turned his life over to Christ. So who are we to point out, correct, take stands, judge, and deal with? When Christ Himself did. I think that's the beauty of the story. Yes, righting the sins, but He showed the way He deals with people as individuals. He does not want to embarrass. And here was a powerful appeal. You said it exactly right, Terry. Powerful appeal. Does no good. But that's just who Christ is. Jim?
I was just thinking, so what we mentioned before, He began probably with the elder, the seniors. And those younger Pharisees and Sadducees could see what was happening. And I imagine that would drop the rock out of their hand.
Yeah. I mean, you could just hear the thud, 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 thud of those rocks dropping.
Don't you think that would be intensely angry too? Because how did he find that out? You know.
Yeah, you would think. You know, as Terry said, you would think. I mean, what other conclusions can you come to?
I never thought of that before as a miracle, but it is. It's an act of a miracle. He is writing down.
We haven't got to the miracle yet. We're getting ready to come to the greatest miracle of all in just a second. Okay. Any comments? Anything that you'd like to add or subtract?
So far.
Yeah.
Well, just a little interesting sidelight here that the reading from which I can't read it in here because the print is too small. The Greek concordance with this, the word that was written down here, that he bent down and to write, is the Greek word, and you know more Greek than I do, graphian, to write. But he wrote, in here, kata, graphian. And when you add that kata to it, is where another idea we get is to write a record against. And that's, I think, where the Aramaic comes up, writing a record against their sins.
Yeah. He just wrote whatever it was, but it was enough they recognized it and they understood exactly who it was and who it referred to. Okay. So now he's made his appeal to these guys and they recognize it. Thud, 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 and they're gone. All right, pick it up.
At this, those who heard him began to go away, oldest ones first, and the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up, and he asked her, "Woman, where are they?
Okay,
no one condemned you?"
Yeah. Okay, let's stop there. Woman, where are your accusers? Do you think she'd been paying attention to any of this?
Watching those stones in the hands.
Okay. Think she had been paying attention to this?
Yeah, I mean, she probably was one,
you know. Okay. Read the next answer when he said, "Woman, where are your accusers?"
Has no one condemned you?
Okay. Then read her reply.
"No one, sir," she said. "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared.
Okay, let's stop there. Okay. She'd seen all of this. What was the law of Moses on somebody condemning? Pardon?
Two
witnesses. Had to have two witnesses. So, Jesus says, "Woman, where are the witnesses?" Well, there aren't any. What did that mean to her at that time? Yeah. Home free. Home free. There are no witnesses. Had to have two. They're here. So let's pick up with the woman again.
Okay.
Now, why did Jesus say that?
So his position was clear.
What do we learn from that, and how do we take that and apply it today?
Apply it literally.
Pardon?
I think we should apply it literally.
Okay, what does that mean?
Not be judgmental, not be critical, not disfellowship people.
Maybe apply it to the guilt we carry around.
Okay. Why did he tell her that he didn't condemn her?
As an example to us, if he doesn't condemn, what would give us the right?
Okay, so if we're in a total vacuum and it's just him and her, he would have condemned her then?
No.
Pardon?
Okay. No, he was here to be the forgiver.
Of who he is.
What does that mean? Repeat that again.
He was here to be the forgiver.
Okay. I can understand that.
Well, then, go back to this beginning here. The Pharisees addressed Jesus as Rabbi. Now, when you give a person that title, that means he is a person of authority, that what he says should be listened to, and all this. Well, when he says, "Neither do I condemn you," with he speak as far as they're concerned, just like one of the highest priests in the whole bunch. That he wasn't condemning it, but he had the authority. And authority can go one of two ways. One of them is to condemn, to punish, do all these bad things that we do to people today. Or else authority means that we rehabilitate you. And that's what he told that lady.
Okay. What were you going to say, Jim?
She and Simon got the same message. Simon took it to heart and had a change of heart. Christ gives her the same opportunity. He says, "I'm not condemning you. I'm giving you an opportunity. Go." Mm-hmm. Same as Simon. Same as Simon. The same message that the priest got. They had an opportunity.
All got it. One takes it. What risk did he run when he says, "I do not condemn you"?
He was condoning if he's not condemning.
Yes, sir. We got to take a stand so we're not misunderstood.
Yeah.
didn't say you're saved.
No.
He didn't say like the thief on the cross. You're
huh? You know. Now, so, in the second part of that, though, he also said,
Don't
do no. Don't.
Okay. So then he finished it up. Neither do I condemn you.
It says, now go and leave your life of sin.
Okay. What does that mean?
Stop it.
To me, if you just think of it, okay, your dad says don't cross the street. You do, and you get hit, break a leg. He goes, okay, don't cross the street anymore. You only broke a leg this time. I'm not going to be here to save you every time. Do it again, they're going to stone you. I mean, it depends on how you think of it.
Okay. What do y'all think that means?
Well, I think, to me, it's a matter of recognize you've been... I mean, if you think about not sinning anymore, it's really recognizing God's love and staying in that presence of love.
Okay. What was her sin, by the way?
Supposedly, she was accused of adultery.
Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any doubt that she was an adulterer. What was her sin? What was her problem?
I don't know, but I think back to the story of Joseph when Potiphar's wife tried to get him. He said, I cannot sin against my God.
Okay. What's the root of everybody's problem that's on the wrong path?
With God.
Absolutely. So when he said to her, go and sin no more, the actual Greek says, go and not stay in a state of continual sinning. What was he telling her?
Well, this was breaking her relationship with God, and he was wanting her to not.
Yeah. Wouldn't it have been a nice time to have given her a nice Bible study on the effects of committing adultery and how downgrading it is?
Well, I think she probably knew that.
Absolutely. You see, when the devil has you caught in the pit of sin, you do not have to have anybody come along and remind and tell you that you're in it. The reason he says, I don't condemn you, was what most likely had happened through her entire life.
Say that again.
When Jesus came along and said, I do not condemn you, what most likely had been going on through her entire life? She had been condemned by everybody.
Even the ones that were using her.
Absolutely. One of these guys was her uncle. She was used to being condemned. People that are caught and in the hold of Satan, in the pit of sin, are used to being condemned. So who in the world do we think that we can come along and really get their attention by condemning them more? Jesus said, neither do I condemn you, because this was the first time, most likely in her life, that she heard something that was life-saving and life-changing. He said to her, the most beautiful words can be said. I don't condemn you. I know where you are on your spiritual journey. Let's start a new journey together. So don't go and keep on going down the path that you're on. That's what he meant when he said, don't sin. Didn't say, go and make another mistake. He said, don't go and keep on sinning. Don't go and keep on going down the path that you're on. And it touched her heart. All her life she had heard nothing but condemnation, betrayal, unlove, being used. And here somebody says, I'm not like that. I'm your friend. Let's go on a different path. That's why I think this is perhaps the greatest miracle of all. Because he took an unwanted, unloved, unkept, bottom of the heap and said, follow me. And it touched her heart.
That whole story that she stood in the midst of, the bottom line of it was, you are of great worth.
Yes.
And she
did. Yes. Nobody had ever told her that you're worth something. How do we apply it to us today? Pardon?
I said, we're in her place.
We've all been in her place. That's exactly right. To what degree? Don't know. We've all been there. When you're there, what in the world does the religious people think they can heap on you any more than the circumstances you're in that's heaped on you? They can't add to that problem.
Saying we already recognize our guilt. They want to give us more.
Absolutely.
We don't need it.
Absolutely.
When we see, when this woman met Christ, then she recognized her guilt. And she was then convinced how to deal with that guilt. He said, they're gone.
That's right. Nobody had given her a light at the end of the tunnel. Nobody had given her hope.
Two things struck me.
Okay.
When Leroy talked about the graphon, the handwriting, what was that? What was the first part of that?
The key. What was the K word?
What was it? Keta?
Yeah.
Keta graphon?
Okay. Yeah.
And it says the woman was put in the midst. It reminded me of the little story in Colossians 2, 13 through 14, 15 maybe. And it talks about Christ in his grace having forgiven you all your trespasses, having obliterated the handwritten document. That was called in the Greek the chirographon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it says it was directly opposed to us, and he removed it from the midst. That's where that woman was standing,
mm-hmm.
in the midst. And what I like about this, it says that chirographon, which was a record of our sins, was nailed to the cross and taken out of the way. So this is, to me, the completion of that story. It's gone.
Mm-hmm. Try it.
It is an addition to the good news.
The beauty about God is always say that people say, well, he forgets our sins. Then my next question invariably is, then God has amnesia. See? The key to it is he treats us just like he treated that woman. Total respect. No condemnation. Just go and follow me. But the beauty of this story was, look at the respect and the kindness that he treated the biggest hypocrites in the world. The same kindness, the same respect. That's who he is. The condemnation comes from their own acts.
Yeah, from what they did with it.
See?
This is the same story we talked about when we talked about the the man who owed $20 million and the one who owned $10 million.
Exactly right. The story never changes. He treats them with kindness and respect.
And what's fascinating to me is, of course, I'm in counseling where I work with people sometimes weekly, and I'm thinking he had that one experience, and we have an image of her going out and understanding it and doing that. And I think that shows you the power of that mm-hmm. it's we don't have to sit there and make sure they understand all of this. If they respond to that love mm-hmm. and that thing, they mm-hmm. will know what to do.
That's exactly right.
Well,
so.
That's where I think this one, it's similar to the woman at the well issue. Because she went to the well in the middle of the day when it was hot out, when nobody else was there. And he spoke to her.
Yes.
She was surprised at that.
Yes. See? That's that continual line from the book of Genesis throughout the entire Bible. God is the same. Circumstances make things different, but it's that same loving character that comes all the way through. So what's the lesson? To some, we've been in the position of the woman. Says, I don't condemn you. The condemnation is already reaped in what you've done. Let's change the course. Let's change the path. And let's go on down this one. When you fall, I'll help you get up. The other is, who in the world are we to criticize, throw stones, point out, uphold against any of our brothers and sisters? Jesus won more people by kindness than he ever did preaching. And you can imagine at the cross, if that woman was there, and she was, when he said, Father, forgive them, she was one of the few that understood forgiveness. Father in heaven, help us to be kinder, wiser, closer to Thee. Help us to have an understanding that to show care and love is not condoning what people do, but trying to show them a better way. Again, I personally thank You for this group, and we pray that You'll continue to bless us. In Jesus' name, amen.